Hey gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Board, a podcast where we talk about the history behind board games. And today I have a special guest, one of my favorite guests, David Thompson. How are you doing today, David?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So for people who don't know how awesome you are, want to give us your elevator pitch?
Oh, gosh. Of how awesome I am? That's an awkward elevator pitch.
David is the designer of some excellent war games through Danvers and Games, one of which is Pavlov's House, another of which is Castle Itter, and he's also the co-designer of Undaunted Normandy and the upcoming Undaunted North Africa, which I know we're all very excited about, and that is only a few of the games on his resume. But David, I've brought you on today to talk about the Battle of Mortain. So you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a key battle during Battle of Normandy, right? So World War II. And one of the most sort of, I guess, key elements about it was the main focus of a massive counterattack planned by the Germans, right? So it was a German attempt to cut off the U.S. as they're making their way through Normandy and France. And so what really caught my attention about this battle is I've done a lot of research into the 30th Infantry Division, right, in the U.S. 30th. And because that's the unit my grandfather was in. I did a lot of original research when I traveled to Normandy a few times when I lived in the UK. And some of that can show up, you know, lightly in Undaunted Normandy, right? And so as part of that, you know, as I was doing the research for Undaunted Normandy and going to all these battlefields that the 30th fought at in Normandy, the one that really stuck with me was Mortain, right? Because it was a key battle, regardless of what unit fought it, and it was probably the single most important action by the 30th Infantry. So that's why I settled on the Battle of Mortain as a future game project and as a area to explore.
So you have been using some really intense research methods to map out what is happening in this battle, including GIS. Can you tell us what kind of work you're doing with that right now?
Yeah. So what happened, you know, is so my day job, right? I'm an intelligence analyst for the U.S. Department of Defense. And so for the last 20 plus years, I've been involved with remote sensing, which for people that don't know, it's basically, for the most part, you can imagine taking a picture with an asset that is not you wherever you are taking the picture, right? So it's either an aircraft or a satellite or something like that. So anything like that is called remote sensing, right? So you're what we call exploiting. You're just basically looking at the imagery, deriving intelligence from that. Historically, that would be called imagery intelligence. Now, there's a whole nother side of that world that incorporates GIS, right? So geospatial information. And so you can think of that as mapping, analyzing the Earth, right, to show its impact in a battle, for example, or movement of troops, etc. So that's my day job. And when I was going through the Battle of Mortain, one thing that really struck me is I've got about, you know, on my desk behind me, I've got about 15 books about the battle. And when you read about it, it's really difficult when you are trying to get a very tactical sense of how a battle at the operational scale unfolds if you want really high fidelity information about troop movements, right? So you can read a book about, a battle for a small town and really get a good understanding, or you can get a really high level view, like I said, operationally, if you're reading a few pages. But if you're trying to sort of combine the two of those, it's really difficult to sometimes combine a narrative in a book and just a few maps. Maybe you have a map of like one day of action and you just have these huge, you know, unit symbols and you're trying to really understand the fidelity. And that led me to apply some of my day job, right? So GIS background, remote sensing background, to understanding the battle in a new way.
So this is not the first time that you have gotten really into the nitty gritty of your war game research. So I know that for Pavlov's House, you read a lot of original source material, hunted down images of people who were at the battle to the best of your ability. And I know that in your upcoming game By Stealth and Sea, which is about Italian frogmen trying to ride torpedoes and blow up British ships, you actually looked at ships' logs to see what ships were present on the days represented in your game.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, why this level of detail? Why do you think that it is this for your own pleasure, or is it something that you think enhances your game, or both?
I think it's both, for sure. So let's take the first one. I definitely enjoy digging super deeply into relatively obscure topics in military history, right? So I really just genuinely enjoy that. I will say there's absolutely in the back of my mind when I'm designing a game, there is a huge insecurity that I have with, I don't want to put a game out that somebody is going to immediately shoot holes in the historicity of the key elements I'm trying to evoke, right? So to be clear, I'm not saying that any game I'm designing is simulationist, or I'm trying to recreate the battle as it unfolded, but
right.
There's always going to be like key elements that I'm trying to evoke in the actual game. And I want those to feel historically relevant, if not accurate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Also, I mean, I really appreciate your attention to detail, because for me, I actually end up learning a lot as I dig into your games about whatever the game is about. So as you're doing all this mapping of troop locations and movements, how do you think that that's mechanically going to play out in your game about the Battle of Mortain?
Yeah, so one thing I try to start with is primary sources, right? So probably the first 2 or 3 months of this project was spent collecting after action reports and interviews of each of the individual units at the smallest echelon possible. So there's a lot of like platoon level and company level interviews that I was able to find. And one thing I learned, and this was news to me, and anybody that has any interest in mapping or anything like that, well, I think this is kind of a cool nugget. I was going through some of these after action reports, and I kept seeing these six number coordinate references. And so
okay.
I struggle, right? Like I live in the world of, and I'm going to try not to get too nerdy here if people don't care about this stuff, but I live in a world of degrees, minutes, seconds, right? Which is probably the thing many people are familiar with. You see a coordinate system and it's got some numbers and a north and east or whatever. Or decimal degrees, which is a different system. If you're in the military, you're familiar with something called the military grid reference system, which is a grid system that has a combination of letters and numbers. And none of that really matters, except they're all different grid systems, and they'll all eventually put you in a very specific location on the Earth for whatever purpose you're trying to derive. So I keep seeing these six-digit numbers, and I'm like, at first I thought it might be, like I said, the military grid reference system. But what I ultimately discovered is all of the U.S. at the time, the Army was using a system called the British Modified Coordinate System, which I started digging into, and I won't bore anybody with it, but it's just really cool to see, in 1944, there was a system of coordinates that I had never heard of in my entire life, and once I sort of cracked the code on what that was and how to convert it, it got me to the point where I could plot each of these individual units down to like the, 10 meter accurate level of positioning. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So gone are the days of these massive, unit symbols that kind of overlap an entire town, right? Now I can get down to really no kidding exactly correct positions for the game, if it matters. So I just wanted to tangent a little bit. So what that means is I'm using a tool called ARC Online. There are tons and tons and tons of different GIS systems. That's just the one I chose because I wanted to make all of my data available to the public when I was done. So independent of the game that's designed, the public will have this hugely rich resource of each location that I decide to create. So down to like maybe even the squad level, will have its exact position. It'll have the day, it'll have a 3 month or a 3 hour period of time, and it'll have the leader of the unit if I knew that, right? So those are the kind of the key things. And the reason I decided on 3 hour swaths is because I wanted to be able to generate a map of the Battle of Mortain for every 3 hour increment over the battle's, 5 or 6 days that it occurred.
That's amazing.
Right. Yeah. So that was the goal. That was the goal. And I'm literally, I've probably at this point created maybe 500 what I call observations or data, data points. And right. I'm probably 15% done, would be a guess.
So this design's going to be a while just from the research.
The good news is, you know, there's a difference between that project and the actual game and what the game will use. Like the game will this project helps me understand the flows of the battle.
Right.
But very, very, very little of this will actually ever show up in the game, right? It'll inform the game, but you won't be dependent upon this level of information, obviously.
Fair enough. So have you decided what mechanically the game is going to look like at this point? Is it going to be, you know, is it going to be card-based? Is it going to be something where you're moving chits around? What are we looking at?
So the original intent, and it'll probably still be this, the original intent was to put it as the fourth game in the Valiant Defense series, right? So after Soldiers and Postmen's Uniform. So it probably will look something like Pavlov's House, rather than Castle Itter or Soldiers and Postmen's Uniform. And for those who don't know, what that means is Pavlov's House is a combination operational tactical game, right? So you're controlling operational elements at a very large abstract level, and then you're controlling tactical units at an extremely, you know, like skirmish level, one man equals one counter. It'll probably be something like that. The original intent was not to do the Battle of Mortain. It was to do the defense of Hill 314, which was the most important geographic position during the battle. And so it was going to be, you know, the defense of that hill by a couple of companies and the operational support they received. So it would have been a pretty close comparison to the way Pavlov's House works. But I will say that, you know, going through this project, I've learned a lot about the battle, and I've realized that while that was a key defense, there was also tons of other pivotal defenses that occurred. And so now the challenge for me as I'm designing the game is, how do I incorporate multiple different simultaneously occurring key tactical defenses into the design? So it will morph. That was the original intent, but this is what always happens, right? You go through the research and you're like, actually, that's not going to be what I, you know, the final vision.
So basically, we're taking something that's like what you did with Pavlov's House, but is expanding to cover multiple key points during a battle instead of everything centering on just that one house and the support that it was receiving.
Yeah, that's the plan right now. So we're probably 2 years out, I would think, right, realistically. And so who knows what'll happen by then? Because the game design literally hasn't started, right? And it probably won't start for 6 months to a year.
Honestly, I'm amazed that you're that good at scheduling. So,
well, now here's the good or bad news, depending on your perspective, is it's competing with like five other projects, right? Game design projects. So it's like trying to squirrel in the time to do the research for this while dealing with some other deadlines.
That's fair, honestly. I mean, I know you've got a busy schedule. So I'm also really interested in the fact that you said you've been reading interviews with people who were at Mortain. What kinds of stories are emerging from the interviews that you're reading? Tell us some of the interesting perspectives you've encountered during that research.
Well, yeah. So a lot, I mean, you know, it was, so first of all, there, I guess it ranges from everything from an S3, which is like the ops lead, operations lead for a unit, all the way so they would be recording like as the actions happened, right? It was like a log of activity, and that's just normal. That would just happen anyway. But that's really good because that's just like an objective view of the actions that are occurring. So like it'll record things like the time of day and orders that were happening and troop movements and stuff like that. It is just what's going on. Now the other part of that would be it was common after these key battles occurred to do troop interviews with a wide range of different people. So you'll sometimes read an interview with, you know, an enlisted person all the way up to maybe a captain or something like that in a company. And they would typically just interview whoever was key people in the action. So some of the cool things I've read, you know, is, well, not cool. Some of the things that have left an impact on me is I just got through yesterday. There was an area north of Mortain, a little town, and it was being held by a company, right? So we're talking, you know, about 130 guys. They had moved in. All of the people that participated in this battle, the 30th Infantry Division, were basically at their location for less than a day before the battle began. They were relieving a different unit. And so they weren't really even in their positions they weren't dug in. They weren't really expecting an attack. There was, they expected no enemy action, really, because they were told by the unit they were leaving that there's nobody really around. So they weren't really ready for the, well, they definitely weren't ready for the attack.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's bad. And we did have, like, ultra intelligence that said an attack was coming, but there's a debate about whether or not that information was held back so that we wouldn't tip to the Germans, that we had the intelligence. So there's a, you know, there's the typical, it's not just a battle, right? There's tons and tons and tons of backstory. But so this company moves in, and it has just been reinforced with new recruits. So a lot of the guys were super young. The officer in charge had been there for a week. So a new officer, brand new officer going to this company, lots of new guys, they go into position, been there for just a few hours, and they get attacked by, and these are just riflemen, right? They had towed tank destroyer guns, but they had no tanks themselves, no tank support. And they get hit simultaneously by a Panzer division, elements of a Panzer division, and elements of an SS Panzer division. So tanks, German Panthers and Panzers rolling in with just guys with some towed anti-tank gun.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. And I mean, it was bad enough that, like, they had platoons being commanded by sergeants, not even lieutenants. So that gives you an idea of, like, how rough it was. These guys went from, on the first day of battle, having, I think the company was 135 guys. By the, you know, 6 hours later, they were down to 35 guys. And by the end of the battle, there was one officer and 16 guys that lived from that original 135.
Oh, so, man.
Right. And I'll tell you, this may sound weird to you, right? But
no, I've heard a lot of things. I'm ready.
Yeah. When I'm going through and I'm creating these data points, what I'll do is I'll create the data point when a unit arrived at a location, and I'll create a data point when it departs a location. And so then from that, I can infer, because I'm doing a lot of what we call spatiotemporal analysis, meaning like a combination of time and space, unit tracking to understand what's going on. So it's important to know when a unit arrives, when it departs. Usually what that means is I track a unit. So pick any random unit and I track it all around the battlefield, and you can understand what it's doing by where it goes. In this case, I stopped tracking units because the unit ceased to exist. And that's really, really depressing, right? So, I mean, it sounds weird, but it's like, oh, I don't have to create that symbol anymore because that unit doesn't exist anymore.
So, yeah, how emotionally attached do you end up feeling to these battles as you research them? It seems like you don't just, I like that you're not just tracking dudes on a map, right? You're actually reading interviews, thinking about what happened to these units. What does that do to you during your process of game design? How does that change your relationship with your material?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what, you know, I think you know that when I'm doing games like Pablo's House and Castle Litter, I like to get super, well, and by Stealth and Sea recently too. Like, to me, I always love including the guys' pictures, their names, background information and stuff. And when I'm digging through this, it's super important for me to kind of get as close to the individual person as I can. And so I want players, when they play the game, to be able to, you know, I was reading another sort of story about a weapons platoon leader. So that was his job. He was to be in charge of the weapons platoon. But ultimately, throughout the battle, he winds up commanding two different platoons, neither of which was originally his, and he's leading them all over the place. And I want people to come away understanding what Lieutenant Rob, you know, what life was like for him, right? How the chaos and that kind of stuff. And so that's my ultimate goal. It's not, I don't really care if, like, on the GIS project side, I want people to understand objectively what happened. On the game design side, I want people to get as close to these personal stories as possible and be able to experience that as closely as they can for themselves.
And that's true for you and your game design. One thing that I have noticed is that you do a lot of research, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your games are mechanically complicated. Your games are usually very action focused, and they're focused on creating a story. So, for example, by Stealth and Sea, the first mission that was the one that we all played for the Kickstarter preview, isn't the most exciting mission because none of the equipment works. It's the luckiest mission, I bet, in the whole campaign. Yeah,
for sure.
Because you're starting with nothing, and yet you made a decision to begin your game with a mission like that. Is that the reasoning that you're trying to create the story over creating a game that you can min-max?
I think so. I mean, part of it is, and I could be wrong on this, but I would submit that war gamers are more forgiving with game designs like that than your average Euro gamer, right? So this is just a fact, right? Players oftentimes will never play a game more than once, and their entire impression of that game is going to be based on the first play. And so there's, in typical game design, there's a huge concern about your first play being really good, right? Like giving a good impression, giving a good sense of the game. And so if I'm designing a game like War Chest, I have to keep that in mind. But if I'm designing a game like by Stealth and Sea, I hope I can say, well, as long as the players understand that this is the first scenario and they have the opportunity to progress, and this is based on the historical situation, I think I have a little bit more leeway to get away with that kind of stuff. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the approach I take, for better or worse.
I think that's fair enough. And then I actually had one other question, which is using GIS in your games like this the closest that you've ever brought your gaming life and your work life?
Yeah, so I have to be super careful, right? Because everything I do in my work life is like 99% of it's super class, or not super class, it's classified. So I will never, ever, ever design a modern day conflict kind of thing that could be even remotely related to my work job. Now, the fact that using GIS to track, you know, World War II units that's totally fine, right? That's all just work knowledge and tradecraft maybe, but it has nothing to do with my actual job. So that's fine. But certainly it is the closest, right?
Does it feel weird? Like, does it affect your work-life balance to have game work that uses some of the same skills as day job work?
Well, so here's the thing. I grew up, you know, I kind of like super broadly, broad strokes covered this, but in my world, the remote sensing folks, it's kind of a different tradecraft and different job jar than the GIS focused folks. You might not, that might seem strange to somebody on the outside, but like, well, those things are very, very related. And why wouldn't that one job? But you start to get super niche and you focus on one or the other. And I grew up in the remote sensing side. I did not grow up as a GIS person. So for me, a lot of this is actually, I'm learning more about GIS than I ever have before by doing this project. And I don't get to do it at work. I'm a senior analyst, which basically means I don't do work anymore, right? It's like reviewing reports and that kind of stuff. My day is filled with meetings, not actually like, you know, the job that I grew up doing. So it's been really actually, fun, right? Like, I don't know. Like, I just feel like I'm creating information for people that they can use and stuff. And it's just, it's invigorating. It's energizing. So it's good.
Yeah. And that is also something that you've done in the past. You typically create companion books to go with your historical games. I also feel like creating this public information about unit movements is maybe a new level of contribution for you. Are you seeing your game design research as contributing something more to the world at large in addition to informing your game?
I think in this case, like, I haven't thought about it in terms of the historic or the other designs, right? Like, the companion book, the intent of those is to provide specifically for the game player extra background information should they care, right? Like, that's certainly the goal for those. Now, in this case, with this project, yeah, absolutely. The intent was, I want to provide something not just to the wargamer community, but like a broader, you know, military history enthusiast, GIS enthusiast, those kinds of folks, much more broadly. And I don't know if this, I mean, my ultimate goal, and I've been working with a couple of other guys I know from work as we go through this, because there's also plans to do some data visualization, data analytics on the backside with all of the troop movements. So not just map depiction, but, you know, roll up the data to do other interesting things with it. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I would like to see, this would be perfect world, would be other people say, wow, that's an interesting approach. Maybe I should apply that to a battle. that would be the ultimate goal. So we'll see. That may be, you know, just pie in the sky, but I think that would be awesome.
All right. So before I let you go, I just want to ask one more question, which is, are you playing anything good right now yourself, or are you just designing?
So I've been playing every once in a while. I'll get on Tabletop Simulator, right, with people. Well, first of all, I've been playing tons of stuff with my kids, almost mostly Dungeons and Dragons, but we'll play other stuff too. But it's very, very D&D heavy in this house right now with my kids.
No.
Otherwise, yeah, they also just got their first own sets of dice, which was very big. My kids are 11, 9, and 6. So now they have their own very own sets of dice. They have their own spell cards. So we've been leveling up their D&D swag lately. Okay, but as far as like other legit gamings, it's been Tabletop Simulator, right? So one thing that I got to play recently that I've only played a few times before was Freedom the Underground Railroad. And if you'll indulge me, I want to talk about your recent podcast discussion with Michael Kelly. Right?
Absolutely.
Because this came up right during your podcast. You guys had a very brief discussion about specifically Freedom, but more about the relevance it has in modern day vice, like say World War II or Vietnam or whatever. And
yes,
I thought that discussion was spot on, and it made me think about Freedom as compared. So for people that don't know, Freedom of the Underground Railroad is, as the name would suggest, a game about, you know, the slavery in the United States, right? And it's a co-op game, and you're all working together to try to free slaves. But I think it's interesting to compare it to a game like This Guilty Land. Have you played This Guilty Land, or do you know it?
I have not, but I know of it. I know it is a Hollenspiel game that really brings up some tough issues during gameplay.
Yep. And so I think, now this is very, very much David Thompson's personal opinion, obviously.
That's what you're here for.
I want to talk about the comparison of those two and the feelings they evoke to me when I played them. In Freedom of the Underground Railroad, you're all working together, okay? In This Guilty Land, it's a two-player head-to-head game where somebody's taking the role of the Confederacy, right? And somebody's taking the role of the Union. Right?
Yes.
I think, personally, well, I kind of almost refuse to play the Confederacy in that kind of game, right? That, first of all, but if I did, I would play them in an extremely detached way, right? I don't think I would get a ton out of that experience because I would be so detached from the experience that it wouldn't really resonate with me. Now, compare that to Freedom the Underground Railroad, where we're all working together. It's a shared experience, which I think is more emotionally impactful to me, at least. And I'll tell you what, you're making decisions in Freedom, especially towards the end game. You have to make a decision about trying to get the last few slaves to Canada to win the game. But that means you start to ignore slaves that are still on the plantations and haven't moved at all.
Ooh.
And they start to move to the captured slaves box, right? And so there's no game of Freedom the Underground Railroad that any like normal human being in my mind would play that at that end game decision making process where you're like, okay, well, to win the game, we just need to concentrate on getting these last few cubes to Canada. That's a horrible feeling every single time you play. Horrible. You just stop almost caring about winning the game at that point, and you're just like, this is really bad.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a tangent. I just wanted to bring that because you all brought it up, and I thought, I was like, why does Freedom resonate more to me than This Guilty Land? And I think, to me at least, that's why.
Yeah, and actually bringing it back to your own games, what's interesting is that emotionally, I do think that you kind of step into the shoes of whoever you play. And I think, especially playing the Confederacy in something like This Guilty Land, that would be very difficult for me. And yet, I found myself having a great time as an Italian torpedo writer in By Stealth and Sea. And I was wondering if you had gone through an emotional process on that, or, you know, if it, because it was a different feeling of game, it didn't feel like, oh, I'm playing as the Axis and that's bad.
That's a good question. I had an emotional roller coaster with that design. I think you know this, but it was originally a commissioned design. So somebody came to me and they wanted to do a very simple game. They wanted to do one scenario. They wanted to commission it. And I won't talk about the details of that, but it was important to know that, like, that's not like Pavlo's House or Castle Litter or Mortain, where it was me saying, hey, I want to do this. So we kind of started in a different place. When they asked me to do it, I did not say yes immediately. I said, well, let me just read into it, think about it. And I struggled. Like, I was like, I don't really know if I want to make a game from this point of view. Now, by the time it was all said and done at the end of it, it didn't bother me anymore. And I think the reason for that is they weren't terrorists, right? They were military guys. They were not politically aligned until that. Now, Exmos, the guys that the game is about, after Italy capitulates, they actually become really, really, really horrible dudes doing all sorts of bad things. But that's after the war, and that's mostly different people. Okay, so I think people sometimes conflate that unit, and they think of all the craziness they did afterwards. But up until, you know, Italy's capitulation, they were a legit military unit. And so I wound up sort of reconciling. And then, you know, as I dug more into it, I was like, you know, these guys, for the purpose of like establishing military tactics and stuff, are some of the forerunners of all naval mm-hmm. commandos. And so, I actually came to grips with it and was able to, I think, see it from multiple perspectives, right? But for sure, there was a period where I was like, I don't really know if I want to design a game around, you know, with Italians attacking British primarily ships in harbor, right? Like I couldn't, and I would never. There's no way in the world. Like if somebody said, hey, I want you to design a game about terrorists blowing up whatever, you know, innocent something. That's just not going to happen, period. Right.
Right. Well, I mean, don't you avoid modern conflicts generally for that reason?
Yeah, I do. There's mostly because, you know, I've been deployed to Iraq, right? Like I've worked in the types of places where a modern conflict would most likely be set. And I just struggle with the idea of there's no way I can possibly model a modern conflict without potentially hurting someone. Right. That's my mind. Like, I just don't know how I can make that happen. And so I kind of stay away from that. I will say that I'm consistently, there's a battle for a specific outpost in Afghanistan. And I've been asked tons and tons and tons of times. It happened in 2011. It was a conflict to model that specific thing. So it's possible that one day I'll look at doing that. But it would be, I would have to work with the key people that were involved with it. And I'd have to work with the military to make sure everybody was happy with it. It would just be so much extra work. I'm not sure it's worth doing.
Extra work, says the man who has only plotted 15% of his pile of more pain points.
That's right.
David, thank you so, so, so much for coming on this podcast and talking to me, talking to us about your research and the impact it's having on you and the impact it might be having on all of us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me. This has been awesome.
So everybody, if you have questions for David and me, please feel free to contact us both on social media. I'm Beyond Solitaire everywhere. And David, where can you be found?
Probably the easiest place is Twitter. I'm @DJackThompson.
So thanks again, David, and happy gaming, everybody.